hard it is to get even one Michelin star and how that system works.
Chefs live and die by the Michelin guide, especially European chefs, especially fine dining. Quite literally, people have committed suicide. I can name you five chefs that have committed suicide in the last 20 years from losing a star.
Today, my guest is Chef Dale McKay. Originally from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, McKay's culinary career began as a fry cook in Vancouver, BC. He then moved to London, England, where he began working at Gordon Ramsay's Claridge's restaurant. He eventually returned to Vancouver to become the executive chef at Daniel Boulud's Lumiere restaurant, where the restaurant was awarded the AAA Five Diamond Award under his direction. After winning Top Chef Canada and starting his own Vancouver restaurant, McKay returned to his hometown where he founded the Grassroots Restaurant Group. Working in his restaurants and around Gordon, what did that teach you?
Focus and diligence. I've never seen somebody so focused on a specific goal or a number of goals. There's no point have I ever come up with an excuse that was good enough for him. He never really yelled like on television in the sense of just a yell to make a show. He couldn't understand how the fuck you aren't perfect. Why did you not take all those steps to make sure that you didn't screw this up?
How do you feel about the trends of celebrity chefs?
You know, I think it's all...
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. Now, the HubSpot podcast network has incredible podcasts like My First Million, hosted by Sam Parr and Sean Puri. They interview some of the most incredible business leaders, Alex Hormozi, Sophia Amoruso, Hassan Minhaj, who share their journey to success and how they made their first million. On a recent episode, they featured the acquired podcast hosts, Ben Gilbert and David Rosenthal, to discuss how they scaled their multi-million dollar podcast. Don't sleep on My First Million. If you want to get inspired, if you want to learn from the best, you got to tune into My First Million wherever you listen to your podcast. Today, my guest is Chef Dale McKay. Originally from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, McKay's culinary career began as a fry cook in Vancouver, BC. He then moved to London, England, where he began working at Gordon Ramsay's Claridge's restaurant, followed by stints in other Michelin-starred Ramsay restaurants in London, Tokyo, and New York City. He eventually returned to Vancouver to become the executive chef at Daniel Boulud's Lumiere restaurant, where the restaurant was awarded the AAA Five Diamond Award under his direction. After winning Top Chef Canada and starting his own Vancouver restaurant, McKay returned to his hometown where he founded the Grassroots Restaurant Group with Christopher Cho and Nathan Guggenheimer. With this group, he's opened restaurants in Western Canada, including Avenue, Aiden Kitchen and Bar, Dojo, Little Grouse on the Prairie, and Sticks and Stones. In addition to his Top Chef Canada win in 2011, Dale McKay has many more accolades to his name, including being named a Western Living Foodie of the Year in 2014, while Aiden made Air Canada's En Route magazine's Top 10 Best New Restaurants list, won En Route's People's Choice Awards for Canada's Best New Restaurants, and was on Vacay.ca's Top 50 Restaurants in Canada list in 2014 to 2016.
I would say seeing a documentary. I saw a documentary called Boiling Point when I was 19 years old. I was given a VHS videotape from somebody that I had worked with at the time. I was working in my first real good restaurant. I would say good in the sense of like making everything from scratch, that kind of stuff. It was in Whistler, BC. I got this VHS. I took it home, watched it, and watched. It was about Gordon Ramsay going for his three Michelin stars. He was 32 at the time. He was trying to become the youngest chef ever to get three Michelin stars. I saw this documentary. It was put on by the BBC, and it was like the most intense thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was like yelling, and I just felt like I was in a completely different world. You know, I felt like I had been in some kitchens and stuff, but seeing the intensity and seeing the level that these people were at, I just wanted it so bad. And so actually literally 3.5 weeks later, I was living in England. So I saw that documentary and I applied for a visa within the week. My mom helped me apply for the visa and I got it back in 3 weeks. And I had a Lonely Planet book because this is like 99. And so I booked a hostel through Lonely Planet book and stuff and booked it for 4 days and showed up at his doorstep. So I feel like I would have done similar, but that documentary just kind of changed my course. I never thought I would just move to England at 19. And that's just kind of what I did. So that documentary changed my life for sure.
And okay, so when you, that's amazing. And I also love a similar thread between everybody that achieves anything is just this,
yeah,
massive action, and it's almost like you throw like caution to the wind, you just go for it, and that's obviously like a huge career shift. So before that, you were the story is you worked as a fry cook, and you were probably doing some small much smaller jobs. So what is the experience actually throwing yourself into cooking, culinary arts as a profession? Because I bet before that video, I'm sure there was still ideas of what else, or if I go different directions, right? It's not like you have a set career path, but now this video solidifies it. It probably expedited the time frame in which you took that step. So what is the career path of a chef, of somebody that wants to be successful in this industry? Do y'all have to go over to London, England? Are there other ways to do it?
I think there's a few paths, but I kind of feel like I almost snuck through the back door for the level that I kind of managed to get to, and the places that I managed to be the chef of, and that kind of thing, and working for who I've worked for and stuff. I left school at 14. I quit school when I was 14 years old. I had a couple classes in grade 9, and then I just left school and I moved across the country to Vancouver, BC when I was 15. On my 15th birthday, I bought a standby ticket when they still did standby tickets, flew across to Vancouver. And then I basically was kind of, I had my brothers that were living in Vancouver, but I was somewhat on my own. And so, I'll start by saying I'm dyslexic. I do a lot of work with Dyslexia Canada as well. I'm an ambassador for them. I'm very proud of it nowadays. Back then, it's a very different situation. So I didn't feel like I definitely didn't have much career options. You know, I was aggressive in the sense of ambitious, and I wanted to be something, and I had a huge chip on my shoulder in the sense of I was willing to outwork everybody, do that. So when I was washing dishes, because I virtually had no other option, you know, there's not a lot of jobs out there for 15 or 16 year old dropouts. And so I was washing dishes at a chain called Red Robin. I'm not sure if you know Red Robin, but it's a burger and Clucks and Greens, and as they call them there. And somebody didn't show up to work one day, and they put me online, and I honestly, from that day forward, I knew I was going to be a chef and I wanted to be a chef. It was just a matter of me, you know, 15 or 16 year old, you know, dyslexic kid that really was partying a lot and, you know, doing a lot of, you know, everything, basically just kind of finding his way. And then, so, that documentary really kind of gave me the, you know, I was never scared to just throw, obviously I moved across the country when I was 15. I wasn't scared to kind of put myself in awkward situations, but I think that documentary gave me the thought of like, if I can go there and I can be one of these people, I could do, you know, 1 year in Canada is like, I mean, I could do 1 year in England, it would be like 5 years in Canada. That's the way I saw it. I saw it. This is like going, jumping into the army. This is jumping into like the highest level of training possible. So, yeah, I always felt, I think it helped me that I always felt like this is all I had. There was no other option. This is what you had. So put every piece of energy and thought and effort into it. And when I moved to England, it was almost like a sweet release in the sense of I didn't care about anything else. Nothing else mattered. It was only about being in that kitchen 16, 17 hours a day, learning everything I could do. You know, I'm someone, and I'm sure, you know, you interview a ton of people that like, I would always factor in every little thing I possibly could every day. You know, I was having the same containers. I'd hide pots inside of ovens overnight. I would do anything I could to make my day smoother, so I could look that much better and I could advance myself that much quicker. And so I always looked at myself as like the blue collar guy that, you know, I was working with all these people that went to, you know, culinary schools and all these different things and trained and did all these stages all over the world, when I was just that kind of, I think, rough and kind of, I just hustled.
You hustled. You figured. Yeah. And how were you received in London when you came over on a whim? Like, I'm sure that someone was looking at this kid coming from Canada, like,
yeah, you know, and not a lot of, no experience really. Very, I mean, some experience in the sense of being in kitchens, but never Gordon Ramsay level. I mean, when I joined Gordon, he had his restaurant was number one in the world. He was literally the top restaurant in the world. So, showing up there, I was just like, I kind of thought to myself, if I can hang in there and I can work 16, 17 hours a day, they're going to let me be here. You know, and whether I'm picking herbs or I'm on the line, they're going to let me do it, is the way I kind of thought. So I didn't try to send my resume. I didn't try because I had a crap resume. I had nothing going for myself in that sense. I didn't go into school. So I showed up and I knocked on the door and I asked for a job. And they said, come back tomorrow for a stage. And which is a stage in our world is essentially an unpaid day or week or month or however long that may be to trial. And so I went there and I picked langoustines. They're like shrimp for 10 hours. And then I think I cleaned for the rest of the time and they gave me a job. And so I was willing to scrap and fight anybody. And so, and I did, like, I could tell you, like, it was so aggressive and so competitive that you, if you could have a friend in the kitchen, it was great because then you could kind of team up on people. And that's how competitive it was. You had to kind of mark your territory, like you're like a dog, you know, and if anybody came on your station, you'd have to, you know, fight back and bark back. And this is all while, you know, being kind of yelled at by Gordon and by everybody else. So it was usually the most intense kind of situation I think I'd ever be in. It's exhausting, but exhilarating. And yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you see the Gordon Ramsay style of leadership on TV, and I think that that's eye opening for a lot of people, because I don't think a lot of people came up in their career with leaders, yeah, bosses like that. I mean, that's a very high pressure environment, but it sounds like that's not just a facade. That's the way a kitchen is, and the highest, most prolific, restaurants in the world. And that's just something that you have to dive into head first and to deal with, to sort of carve out your spot in the industry. And if you can do that for, you know, X period of time, and you have the passion to sort of persevere, that's, yeah, who sort of rises to the top.
Yeah, and especially in the time, I would say, you know, in the 2000s and early kind of late 90s to kind of mid 2000s, I would say it was probably the hardest core of in all kitchens. There was, you know, it was modernized, but at the same time, yeah, there wasn't many labor laws being touched or kind of like in there. You can't even, like, I was just in England for a couple of months and, yeah, they don't work quite like the hours that we used to at that time, because, you know, the government has stepped in and realized that there's been too many people obviously complaining about these kind of things. But from the better question, a leadership standpoint, I needed that kind of leadership. You know, I kind of thrived in that situation because I love discipline and I love structure. And I was, you know, again, young and just needed some guidance and needed that. So I always looked at it like a boot camp. There's a reason why, you know, armies send people to boot camp. It's to get them in the right frame of mind and put them under pressure and see how that they can perform under pressure. And if you can perform your best while being under extreme pressure, then I would think everything else, and, you know, after that's going to be extremely easy. And I think there's that in all, you know, walks of life, from musicians to athletes to day traders to, you know, all those kind of people that have to deal with that kind of pressure. And so I love that stuff. Like, when I'm even nowadays, when, you know, I have my bigger restaurant and it's a heaving service and you've got, you know, eight cooks kind of going, and you kind of feel like almost like a captain of a ship, and you're kind of pushing resources all around and you're kind of seeing where people are faltering and stuff. And so I love that kind of situation, and I love the intensity, especially when I was that young. Not everybody deals with it well, and it's not for everybody. And I don't even really think it's net totally necessary anymore. You know, I think there's amazing, some of the best kitchens in the world aren't necessarily operating like that anymore. But it can't be all sunshines. We're in, you know, it can't be all like rub your back and say you're going to do better next time, because it's not about that, you know. And when you're, yeah, trying to be the best, when you are the best restaurant in the world, it's a defending game. It's not even it's one herb that's off, you know, or one smudge in the plate can actually take you down a notch. And so you have, you know, people that don't understand that type of intensity or that type of focus, they're not going to get it. But when you spend 18 hours a day doing something that you absolutely love, and some guy comes in and fucks it all up on the last minute, you know, there's going to, yeah, be some things to be said.
Yeah. That's when there's repercussions. That's when you get why the, yeah, pressure exists. And I guess for people that are listening that don't understand the world of Michelin star and don't understand the level that you're playing at, I guess it'd be good to sort of tee up what that means. To draw a parallel, draw a comparison, maybe speak to how hard it is to get even one Michelin star and how that system works, just to sort of show, yeah, the level that you're playing at. And that'll sort of give some context for the rest of the
You know, chefs live and die by the Michelin guide, especially European chefs, and especially fine dining. You know, it's quite literally, people have committed suicide. I can name you five chefs that have committed suicide in the last 20 years from losing a star. Because once you get, Marco Pirawhite, who's a great chef, an English chef, and he always explained, first, your first two stars are, you can be creative and aggressive, and it's an offense. But then after you get to the top, it's pure defense. And so you're just trying to hold on that status. And I mean, it literally is like winning an Oscar for an actor. It's only the elite of the elite is going to ever hold that title. And it's all encompassing. And again, it's financially, reputation, pride, all of it, and so it really is, it's everything to them. I'm glad that I never really got that fever, to be honest with you, and being a Canadian chef, I understood it when I was in it, and I appreciated it. And I feel like I held myself and my team to the same standard when I first got back to Canada, when I was doing specifically fine dining. And I was, at the time, I was the youngest grand chef in the world for Relais and Chateau, which is a kind of the similar kind of thing as Michelin, but it's specifically for the chef, not for the restaurant. So I was awarded grand chef at 27, which was a massive accomplishment for me, and that was enough for me. But because they do an inspection thing, and that's part of the Michelin thing, is if you've ever watched, the documentary Boiling Point 2, a lot of it is trying to figure out when these inspectors are coming in. You've got a list of names, you've got a list of phone numbers, you have your staff checking every day, back checking all these phone numbers. You have it's not just about you hoping, you have to focus that hard to try to make it happen. It's beyond intense.
It is. No, I totally appreciate it, because I mean, if you look at if you look at the level of scrutiny that restaurant, I think that it's also not as prevalent in North America, obviously, as it is in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you've ever been to a Michelin star restaurant, literally anywhere, it's like the level that they compete at is is absurd. I mean, and it extends far beyond just like the food that you eat or the presentation. I mean, it's a service. It's the entirety of the experience.
The bathrooms, right? The purse stools, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
absolutely everything.
Yeah. And it can all be taken away very, very quickly from one inspector. And that's why you have to treat every single person to that level. And, you play little games, like when you think there's an inspector in the room, you'll start sending like you want to send. You want to make sure that they have everything you want them to have. And so, Gordon taught me a lot about other little things. So like you can't treat them special. So you start treating everybody around them special. So they don't realize. So you send an extra course to everybody around. You do all those kind of little things, and you just kind of, it's a whole playbook just to kind of get into that kind of graces.
And working in his restaurants and around Gordon, what did that teach you? And what did you take from that for your own career, your own restaurant? Let's sort of walk through that, because I mean, how long were you actually working in his restaurants before you started your own thing?
I was with him for about 7 years total. I was with him for just over 3 years, or no, about 3 years in England. I was with him 2 years in Japan, and then 2 years in New York. So I managed to, I think I opened up 8 restaurants for him total. When I joined him, I was at the perfect time, kind of when he had one restaurant, and then from there, kind of there was about 8 of us that were kind of his core group that kind of grew and shaped it. I'm sorry, what was your question? I sometimes rant and then I
no I, no the no no it, it's no I appreciate it, it I appreciate the context, but it was the lessons and the experience
took
from working with him over that 7 years.
For me, I would say focus and diligence. I've never seen somebody so focused on a specific goal or a number of goals and driven. There's at no point have I ever come up with an excuse that was good enough for him for anything. There's no excuse for anything. What he can't understand, what I always respect about him is when he was yelling at you, he never really yelled like on television in the sense of just a yell to make a show. He couldn't understand how the fuck you aren't perfect. Why did you not take all those steps to make sure that you didn't screw this up? And that I loved. I love that whole idea and concept of every day thinking about all the little steps that you can take to not let things happen. It's the complacency of people that just go into work or go into whatever and just kind of the day kind of goes on. And if you do that, things are going to go wrong. But if you can kind of set your mind up every day to kind of eliminate steps and constantly. I used to time myself doing everything, not because I was told to, because I wanted to see how much faster and how much more efficient I could get. And that was because from watching someone like Gordon that was just so good at everything, he seemed, and everything, I just turned everything into a competition. And he's very much kind of, I would say, like that as well. And so I thrived to being around that. So, you know, focus and no excuses, you know, it's all on you. You take responsibility for everything.
I love that. Yeah. And we'll speak about how that sort of impacted what you've done with the Grassroots Restaurant Group. But I want to also some things that have happened in your career and also just general trends that I think you'd be good to comment on. So how do you feel about the trends of celebrity chefs and chef competitions and building personal brands? And how, because that is relatively new in the industry too.
Yeah, you know, I think it's all positive. You know, I think there's going to be lots of chefs that kind of bitch about it or say, or the this and that. I mean, there's absolutely chefs out there that have shows and that are, have restaurants and have these big, you know, celebrity chef lives that really are very good chefs. There's absolutely lots of them, you know what I mean? There's also lots of musicians that are very good. There's also lots of, you know, in any industry, but I think the positives much outweigh the negatives in the sense that we have platforms. Social media has given us a platform. Television has given us a platform. We can possibly retire not poor and exhausted. You know, it's never really been a glamorous life. It's one of those jobs that kind of hooks you and that you love and you kind of stick with it. You know, chefs in traditionally have stayed in the kitchen till their 60s, 70s even, especially French chefs and European chefs. It's something you just do forever. I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to be in the kitchen at 55 at 8 o'clock at night. I want to be at home enjoying, you know, my life and everything else. And
as anyone should be after giving so many years of something.
Absolutely. Right? You know,
you should aim for.
Yeah. And so from the celebrity side of things, I think I think it's only good for people. You know, if you watch, say, MasterChef's Kids, it's a great show. You see these kids have a crazy amount of knowledge. They know more about cooking than their parents. They're so impressive. And it's because of Celebrity Chef. It's because of these shows. It's because of access of this, all this knowledge. They can go on YouTube or they can go on Instagram and watch people's reels of how to make all these dishes and stuff. So I think it is very positive. And it's giving us a platform and the ability to make more money, to be honest with you. Like I would say that you know, before the pandemic and when I was doing lots of events and different things, I would say that it was always a strategic goal of mine, to only, you know, my income to only be about 40 to 50% of my income coming from the restaurants and my wage. Mm-hmm. And the rest should be diversified into other things outside of outside the restaurants. And whether that be still food related or not, that was always my goal. And I wouldn't be able to do that without being a celebrity chef, you know, without product endorsements and doing all those kind of things. So, and I actually really enjoy that work. You know, I'm the corporate chef for a grocery chain co-op. I'm not sure if you've ever had them out east. There's about 265 locations. So, you know, I feel very lucky. There's only, you know, a few chefs in each country that are going to get one of those jobs because it's for a national grocery chain. So I develop food. I develop frozen food for them. I develop fresh food for them. I do recipes for them for their website. So that kind of work wasn't around in the 80s and 90s, even in the 90s really. And so, and to me, that's a huge amount of my income. And it also allows me to be in, they wear aprons with my name on it in the grocery stores. I do events for them when they open stores. They do all that kind of stuff. And I think it's the way chefs also look at it too, just like an athlete, you know, doing endorsements for whatever kind of company. You know, I call myself a bit of a sellout. I'll endorse most things as long as I like it and I think it's okay. I'll be,
well, if you believe it, yeah, there's nothing, you know, wrong.
What I mean, I've done commercials for A&W. I've done, you know, things for blue cheese. I've done it, you know, they're all things that I'm okay with. And, you know, and if I can use my voice and I can make, it's a lot easier for me to make $10,000 with a brand than it is making burgers. You know what I mean? And so if you want to be a successful entrepreneur and celebrity chef or mostly an entrepreneur, then you have to kind of realize it's a lot easier making money writing a recipe than it is trying to cook for 50 people every night, you know, and make that same profit. So I celebrate that stuff.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, companies are under pressure right now. Pressure to get more leads, close deals faster, get better insights to create the best experience for their customers. See, a CRM can help, but not just any CRM. One that is easy to set up, intuitive to use, and customizable to the way you do business. Now that's where HubSpot comes in. HubSpot's CRM is an easy for everyone to use on day one solution. It helps teams be more productive. You can drag and drop your way to attention-grabbing emails and landing pages. You can set up marketing automation to give every contact the white glove treatment. Plus, AI-powered tools like Content Assistant mean less time spent on tedious manual tasks and more time for what matters, your customers. HubSpot CRM has all the tools you need to wow prospects, lock in deals, and improve customer service response times. Get started today for free at HubSpot.com.
I fully agree with you. I think that as industries evolve and ways to make money evolve, I think that it's silly to not take advantage of them, especially if it's like a net positive. If you can teach more people, if you can impact more people,
yeah,
because you have that celebrity stat. I mean, why wouldn't you, really?
Totally.
Like you said, you're raising now another generation of kids that are wildly more competent, yeah, in the kitchen than maybe some of their parents are, which, yeah, is not really a bad thing. It's a positive hobby.
No, and to reference to like the shows, like when I being on Top Chef, which when I was on Top Chef Canada, that was 12 years ago now. And so between co-op, them having my aprons and doing recipes and kids tasting the recipes that the parents are making for them, and then seeing, and then kids, I have people coming up to me that are 22 now or 20 years old and saying, I watched you win Top Chef when I was 12 years old with my family and it was amazing and this and that kind of stuff. And so those shows have given me more relationships with people than anything can. I could have 10 of the best restaurants in Canada. That's not going to make that 20-year-old remember watching me win that show and being emotional and following my journey through from week to week. And so I've always said you can't buy that kind of publicity. If I had $2 million, I still couldn't buy that, because it's a connection, yeah, that they're going to have for the rest of their lives. And so when it comes to a birthday or a special day or anything, they're going to come to my restaurants because they have that connection with me from television and from watching me be under pressure, and then also seeing me in co-op and seeing in this. So those things are actually much more beneficial to my actual businesses in the long run than really almost anything else.
Now, speaking about social media, because if you're building a celebrity status, I mean, you're using social media, but there's other trends that where social media intersects with culinary. And I'm curious about where you see that, because in the culinary industry, there's a lot of obsession with Instagrammable food. Mm-hmm. Does that take away from traditional techniques, traditional flavors? Does that jeopardize what a chef would actually want to create just to make something that looks appealing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes to, you know, what I was saying before, you know, some of those people that have got 200,000 or a million followers from doing Instagram food and that kind of stuff. And some of it is really nice and it is fun to watch. I don't actually know how much those people actually make those dishes or not, but there are a huge amount of people online, including myself, that like to watch those reels and actually, you know, and follow along. I don't see them really doing any harm, you know, at the end of the day. Are those recipes great and tried and tested? Probably not. It's more mostly for the gram. I don't really see it as a negative. I think more food is more food. It does definitely become harder for the good stuff to kind of punch out in front of the bad stuff, because the fact there's just so much. Yeah. I was on Instagram for 20 minutes today and I watched 30 reels from P, and I was like, who's doing this? Like, and it seems like everybody's doing it, you know? So I think it is a trend. I filmed a bunch that I have coming out too in a strategic, more of a strategic way. And I'm doing some partnership posts with some kind of bigger accounts and things like that. I like social media, but I don't love it. I'm a pretty outgoing person, but I don't really, I think my part of my problem is that I think that, why do people care? I don't think someone cares what I'm doing today, you know? And so I don't.
You're in your own head though, dude. You're in your own head. People do care. People love it. I know.
It's funny that way, you know? And I'm like, I'm doing this. I'm like, I'm probably going to post this. And I'm like, someone doesn't really give a shit what I'm doing. You know, but maybe they do. Maybe I got to get a little bit more out.
And then I guess last question that I'm curious about, in terms of the evolution of the culinary industry, There's different technologies that are used are starting to be used, like 3D printing, sous vide cooking. What is your opinion on that? Is that a positive, a negative? How does that impact the industry?
You know, I think, you know, evolution of anything is great to a point, but you don't want to lose sight, especially with food. You don't want to lose sight with what's real and what food's really about. And I think as a chef, I can speak for myself that you kind of go in arcs and you kind of come back. And I think I keep referring to musicians and other thing, you know, the same. I think people are like that. You know, you have your period where you're all about, you know, the top or the fine dining or this and that, but then, you know, you come around and you kind of realize that food's really more about, you know, flavor and soul and happiness and how it makes people feel and that kind of stuff. And I've definitely learned that over the years. And I enjoy cooking more casual food, and casual generally means being a bit more traditional in technique and that kind of stuff, and staying away from, you know, I definitely don't need to 3D print anything. You know, I think we have amazing vegetables in Saskatchewan and amazing fruit and meat, and I don't need to change that. I think that's the way I go more towards now. It's more about just having great products and great farm things, and not doing that. But then to say sous vide has definitely changed the way that we can produce things if you use it in the right way. You can get ahead of things. You can change the texture of, you know, you can take a short rib and you can cook it for 60 hours and cut it like a steak, but it'll still be kind of like super, super tender, like a braised short rib. So when you use them in that kind of way, I think it's fantastic because it's kind of opening up your minds to textures in different ways. But I think if you start 3D printing food that you don't need to, then maybe we're just kind of being gluttonous.
You're like almost commoditizing tradition to a point, but it's not. I get where you're coming from. Yeah. So, I mean, if it's for a net positive in the industry, if it's just to reduce expenses, if it's just to expedite, if it's just to make things cheaper, faster, quicker, that's not necessarily the ethos of food.
Yeah. And there was definitely a period of, I would say, a good 5 years kind of in before 2020, or I would say kind of in the early 10s, that everything was being sous vide and everything was being like, I remember going into a kitchen and whose kitchen? Anyway, the sous vide machine had gone down. They had no circulator. And which means, and they were backpacking everything from lamb to fish to beef to everything. And then they quickly realized that nobody in the kitchen knew how to fucking cook meat. Like they hadn't, these cooks had been there for six, 8 months or even 2 years. And there's been no put a pan on, roast that piece of lamb, cook it in some butter, baste it, rest it, to do all that. Because when you're sous-viding everything, it's basically you take it out, you put it in there, the water, you take it out. And if you do sear it, it's already cooked perfectly. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And so it does, I think, new techniques like that take away from the soul and the actual, you're a cook, you need to cook. You know, if you can't cook a piece of meat, you're not a chef, you know? And so if you overutilize it, you do take away from your own training and your own abilities. So I'm glad I grew up in the time period I grew up when we weren't doing any of that kind of stuff. It was just like, you know, when I was on a station at Gordon Ramsay's, I mean, we'd have 5 different meats and 4 different birds on one station, and you'd have to cook all those at once while listening and being yelled at. So, you know, sync goes back to the multitasking and under pressure. So,
yeah, no, okay. So let's speak about building a restaurant empire. So, talk about the transition from and you were working in Ramsay's restaurant for, you said, 7 years. You opened up 8 restaurants. When did Grassroots Restaurant Group start? What was the impetus for that? What was the idea that you wanted to do this, and I guess the thesis for what type of restaurant and then eventually restaurants you wanted to start?
So the first time I went back to Vancouver and I was working for a chef named Daniel Balloud there. So I'd opened up 2 restaurants for him there. He's an amazing chef out of New York. In my opinion, I think he's the best chef in the world. And so we were running those 2 restaurants, and then those restaurants were going to be closed or cease to exist at a certain point. It was right when I was winning Top Chef. And then I decided I was going to open my own restaurant because that was kind of the natural progression of, you know, being a chef and doing all that to be an entrepreneur. So I opened up a restaurant called Ensemble, which was in Vancouver. And the concept was essentially kind of trying to do fine dining, but in a more casual way, fine dining food, but more kind of casual feeling and more kind of upscale in that sense, which was good. And I was quite successful, and we were making money and we were doing quite well. And then I decided to open, I wanted to, you know, open up another restaurant pretty quickly after, which was what much bigger casual restaurant, was a mistake. The numbers didn't work. I learned early on, I've always been really lucky to have some good mentors and good accounting mentors. And I learned early on, if the numbers don't work, then you don't have a business. And I unfortunately, one restaurant took down the other restaurant, and I would say that I did a very mature thing, which I'm quite still to this day quite proud of, is that most chefs and most restaurants, as you'll see, if they're in trouble, you'll start seeing quality go down, you'll start seeing changes in the service, you'll start changing this, they'll stop paying their bills. So
they'll try and save it.
And realistically, if you're smart and you trust accounting and you trust numbers, you know 6 to 8 months to a year out that you're not going to make it unless you can make some very big changes. And in the restaurant industry, that's extremely hard. It takes months and months to change concepts or change things like that. And the writing was definitely on the wall. So I chose to be very upfront. I shut down the restaurants very publicly. I said, these are the reasons why I got over ambitious. My rent is too high. These numbers don't work. And so I shut down those restaurants very publicly about it. And I said, I'm going to, choose to make a life decision. And I've been a single father. I hadn't mentioned this yet. I was a single father to my son since he was, I guess, 3.5, 4 years old throughout my whole kind of career. And so he lived with me in Japan, him and his mom. And then from there, I had custody of him pretty much right after that, when he was about 3.5 years old. So I wanted him to grow up in Saskatchewan like I did. But we were in Vancouver and we were living, downtown in Kitsilano. So I was choosing to shut down the restaurants. I said, okay, well, this is a perfect time to move back, go to Saskatchewan, give my son, the upbringing I think he deserves more, which is a safe place. You jump on your bike, go down to the river, what I think made me the kind of person that I am was growing up there. So I wanted that for him. So made the decision to go back there and open up a restaurant called Aiden Kitchen and Bar, which is named after him. And with great success. And I've been extremely lucky that I had a lot of people that were willing to move their entire lives to Saskatchewan with me, with never even being there. My business partner, Christopher Cho, who's one door down right now, we're in Mexico City together right now. He's been with me 15 years now, and he moved his life to Saskatchewan, and he's my business partner now. And I hired him as a food runner at Lumiere, actually. So we moved to Saskatchewan. We opened up Aiden Kitchen Bar, very successful. We are one of the best new restaurants in the country. And, financially, we did, above my best case scenario, which was amazing. Saskatchewan was in a really good boom at the time. I managed to pay back the entire investment to my investors and to, the partners and stuff like that, I think within 16 months, which is quite unheard of for, I think we raised $1.2 million, which is incredible for a restaurant, and especially in a small town like that. And then from there, we just kind of kept deciding to do new concepts. And we opened up, Little Grouse on the Prairie, which is a small Italian restaurant. My business partner is Korean, and I worked in Japan for a number of years. I love Japanese and Asian food in general. So then we opened up Sticks of Stones, which is an izakaya with sushi. So different concepts. We don't want to ever keep redoing what we were doing. And then Regina is just 2 hours away, and I have family there. So we opened up 2 more there. And so I didn't necessarily say, okay, we're going to open up 5 restaurants over 10 years. But whenever I saw there was an opportunity and I felt like we could grow, I would say that I definitely struggled with overambition throughout my whole career, and I think I've got that.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins. And I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform: accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win.
efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there. And maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done.
Today's episode is sponsored by Belay. And what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.
Under control the last couple of years, and I think ambition is an amazing thing to have, but I also think it can cloud your judgment sometimes because you think that you can just work harder and it will just be better and it will work. Yeah. That's not the case, and I keep referring to numbers, and if the numbers don't work, you don't have a business. It doesn't matter how impassionate you are, how much you want it, or how much people tell you it's great. It doesn't matter. None of those things really matter in the business sense of things. And so we even had a fail in there too. I opened up a pizza place that I thought was going to be amazing and that everyone was going to praise me for because we were using local flour and we were doing all these things and we were making delivery pizza, but it was just better. But at the end of the day, yeah, you realize that people don't want to pay $35 that you need to charge for that pizza, that they could just go to TJ's and get it for 18 or 12, you know? And so that concept didn't work. And I, again, same thing, after 8 months, I said, okay, we're going to keep losing money here, so we might as well just cut our losses and be upfront about it. You know, I know this is a cliche to say, but I honestly celebrate my losses way more than I celebrate my wins, because my losses have always, I've always been okay with losing or from time to time, because it's really kind of reflective of going like, you blew it. You were thinking, yeah, you know, you really need to look at the overview here. Why are you doing this? Are you doing this for you? Are you doing this to have one more restaurant, or is this a financial thing? Is it, you know, all those kind of answers. So I feel like I'm in the best place ever now, or we are, in the sense of our scope and our understanding of each restaurant. And each one has their own individual problems. So for me now, it's more of a food's easy. I always say cooking's easy. It really is. It's especially for really well trained. But the food's the easy part. It's everything else that comes around it in the restaurant industry. It's mostly people. And these days, staff and people are the most challenging thing you could deal with. And I don't think the hospitality is exclusive to that. That's just, I think, people in general right now. The pandemic really, I think, changed people's ideas and views on work and grinding it out and want. So we struggle now to, I think, more now than we ever have, to keep people employed and keep people motivated and keep people wanting to succeed. You know, I wanted to succeed so bad. I don't understand it when other people don't. So it's, you know, I've had to learn. I think being a single father to my son changed me a lot too. And my son is very different than me. Like, we're so similar, but I'm a very intense person. I've always quite into, I don't find myself that intense, but people find me intense. They've told me my entire life. But he's a very calm and different kind of person. And he doesn't deal well with, like, the Gordon Ramsay method of is not going to work with him. You know, yeah, I need to support him and understand him and make sure that he has what he needs to succeed. And me putting him on the spot is not going to do that. And I've realized with him and with my staff that not everybody wants what I want. And so you have to kind of utilize people to the best of their abilities and be okay
and
with
also,
that.
Also, yeah, work with who they are, yeah, work with who, yeah, they are and how they best receive, you know, like their guidance and how they best receive instruction. And
yeah,
no, that's a whole comment. Okay. We'll speak about that in a second,
yeah,
because that's a whole bunch of lessons in leadership and managing and, mm-hmm, and dealing with brick and mortar, you know, brick and mortar during COVID. There's a lot there. Before we completely pivot into those types of lessons, yep, I want to just ask a few more business lessons from you building this out. So, I mean, you raised money, two of the restaurants failed, You raised money again. Mm-hmm. So this is very, and a very expensive venture,
absolutely,
right? And I think that a lot of probably parallels in starting any business,
yeah,
right? Starting a startup, you have to raise money. I think it's interesting that after two restaurants failed, even though one was successful and the second one sort of pulled the first successful one down.
Yes, people still want to
give
me money.
You were still able to raise money again.
Yeah,
people still want to give you money.
Absolutely.
I wish that was a
case. Yeah, no, that's absolutely valid and obviously a concern. But I think, I also think, and going back to the way I shut it down, I think that there's a huge amount of, it was a strategic in my mind, is like, I knew I wasn't done being an entrepreneur. I knew I wasn't done opening restaurants and everything else. And so when I chose to shut down way before I believe anybody else would have, or most people would have, I think that was a large feather in my cap. And I think I actually gained a ton of respect in my community in that sense that I knew things weren't going to work. And so I shut it down. And then I also took on all the debt in that situation. I took on a tremendous amount of debt. I think when I moved back to Saskatchewan, I think I still had $260,000 worth of debt personally for it that I had taken on. And so, yeah, it's, you know, I'm always up front with my investors. My main financial investor, you know, when I first met him and we sat down and stuff, and he's like, okay, well, you know, what do I get when I come into the restaurant and stuff? And I said, good service and good food. That's it. Like there's, you don't get anything, you know, you're not going to get a discount. You're not going to get, I'm not going to kick people out of their chairs when you arrive. None of that stuff. This is a business. You're investing in a business to make money. So if you're investing in a clothing store or a tech company or whatever else, you're not walking in there and getting free shit. So you're not going to, it's the same way with the restaurants. And so, and then he's like, okay, well, when can you promise me I can have the money back or whatever, how long is it going to take? I said, I can't promise you that. This is a high risk investment. I'm going to tell you, I'm investing my money in it, and I'm going to show you, and I'm going to show you financials every month. I'm going to do all that kind of stuff like any good, you know, entrepreneur would. But there's no promises here. Like this is, there's no, I'm not selling you a dream. You know, I'm trying to sell you a business. Whereas I think most restaurants and things like that, you are selling a dream. You know, most restaurants don't even have a shareholders agreement. You know, like they're like, your people just give people money and they're like, okay, well, here's $100,000. And like, they don't even have any real shares or documents, or they're not formally set up companies even really. They're companies, but they're not, there's no structure. They don't have a shareholders agreement. They don't have rules. They don't have all that stuff. So it's technically quite a shady business generally. And so I learned from Gordon Ramsay's group and from Daniel Boulud's group, I always push my, again, I have no education. So when it comes to business, I learned everything from putting myself in this situation. So when we were opening up restaurants for Danielle or for Gordon, whether I was invited or not, I would push myself in meetings. I remember Gordon even looking at me and go, what the fuck are you doing here? And I said, I'm here. I'm just listening, you know, and for in numerous meetings, whether I was invited or not, because I wanted to know how to set up a company. I wanted to know, you know, how these bills were paid or who was doing this or how payroll worked. And even before I was really at that level. And so I was always interested in that. And then again, I've had some good business mentors, but raising $1 million after a couple of losses was stressful. And I was so broke at the time too. And me and my son were living in Saskatoon, living in a rented place. And I used coupons for the first time in my life, you know, to buy pickles. We were eating grilled cheese and I was buying pickles with coupons. And I never thought in my life I'd ever do that or need to do that. But while I was trying to raise this $1.2 million and we managed to, you know, I managed to find two really good investors, and they brought other people into the mix, and I managed to kind of do that. And then from there, each restaurant had less investors, and now three of our places are just myself and my business partner and one financial partner. So there's three of us in the restaurants, which I like the best, and that's the best way to do it. And I think being upfront with investors and constantly showing the numbers and constantly, you know, it gives them confidence and they don't mess with you anymore. You know, I think if you don't report and you don't let people know going, then they're going to want to know what's going on and going to do it. So I think honesty is always the best policy in all respects, especially when it comes to business.
No, I appreciate it. Agreed. And then the other thing that I wanted to understand is from the lessons that you've learned with the two restaurants that were pulled down and went bankrupt for lack of a better term. What is the checklist that you look for when you're going into something new? What's the checklist of between the rent and the location and the foot traffic and the menu and the talent and the, what is your list that you sort of check off when you open something new?
I mean, you mentioned a lot of them. I mean, location is a good one. Rent. I mean, your costs are the biggest thing. It's tough. I mean, they're two different things. If I was to walk in and take over a current restaurant, it would be very different. You know, you can kind of see where they're at and kind of fix things. But when you're opening up a restaurant from scratch and you're taking, most restaurants fail the first year or whatever that scenario is or whatever. I firmly believe it's because of their initial costs, their opening costs. And that's because you get this amount of money and you go over budget by 40%, 50%, sometimes 200% in restaurants. And that has to do with a lot of the time construction, and it has to do with plans, permits not getting approved by the city, being behind 3 months, 4 months, having people on payroll already. Those are the things that generally kill you. And when you're already behind, especially if you're a chef-driven restaurant, it's very hard to be creative when you've got hundreds of people calling you for money and trying, and you think you're not going to make payroll, or you think you're not going to make that. So that kind of business can go internally, go south very quickly right off the hop because of the fact you're under so much financial stress right away. And restaurants are interesting because they're being opened by people that are in hospitality. They don't know what they're doing when it comes to design, when it comes to construction, when it comes to timelines of dealing with cities and toilet slope for plumbing, all that kind of stuff that you learn. And so I've been lucky to learn that stuff through opening so many restaurants for so many other people and being in designing meetings. I was in design meetings before I was even the head chef with Gordon and with Danielle. I would sit there and listen to designers and know the fact that you can get that same door handle for fucking 20% less. We're not designing a home here. We're designing a commercial restaurant. It needs to be good grade, but it doesn't need to be that because the person holding it doesn't care. No. And so those things, a designer can bankrupt you before you even open. And so I think those are the biggest kind of lessons when it comes to opening up a restaurant and staying open.
And then when you are now expanding your enterprise, you're looking to innovate, you're looking to try new things, mm-hmm. but how do you balance out when you open a new restaurant, how do you balance out innovation versus sticking with like the status quo and what customers already know? So when you bring a new product, I think the restaurant is a product, mm-hmm. the food is a product.
Yep.
You want to innovate so you're not just a copy paste of what else is out there, yep. but being a copy paste of what else is out there means there's familiarity.
Yep.
So how do you balance that?
You know, with different concepts, I would say marketing for me is a big thing. I've always done all of our own marketing. I would say Aiden, we'll start with Aiden, is that we did about 40 videos, and this was, I guess, 10 years ago now. We did a series of videos that were kind of sculpted around making Aiden a story rather than just a restaurant. We did, you know, I did a video on meat. I did a video on fish. I did each member of staff that had moved there or that I'd hired. I did a video featuring them, where they come from, why are they here? What are they most excited about the restaurant for? Is it the charcuterie program? Is it this? And so we did that for 4 months leading into the restaurant and kind of building up that hype and making it so personable that you kind of felt like you had to come in and involved in stuff. And we weren't, and the goal there was with Aiden was to do exactly what you said, is kind of give them what they already knew, but we just wanted to make it a bit better. We weren't trying to change them because I'm a hometown kid, but I was coming back, the big Top Chef guy coming to the city. You know, I didn't want them to think, oh, we're going to be stuffing, you know, fancy food down their face and stuff. And so like we open, you know, we have burgers, wings, we have popcorn prawns, we have all the things that all the other chains or people know, but we just do them better and we make them in house. And so it was more about trying to kind of make sure that get that message across and make sure that people understood what we were and creating this kind of buzz. Like when you came in, you felt already you're a part of something. So we do that with everything. Even like when we opened our Korean Japanese place, you know, we actually got my business partner's mom to come over from Korea, and she spent like weeks with us making kimchi and doing all this. We filmed all that, and we let people know what we're doing. This, we're doing it for the right reasons, we're doing all that kind of stuff. And so I think attaching yourself emotionally to people and giving them a story and is a big thing in our industry. At least it's easy just to put up a menu and kind of thing. You need to tell a story if you really want to kind of capture people, and especially if you want to hit it hard off the start, you need to kind of create that buzz. Mm-hmm. And again, some people, I think too, you need to be able to try to do some of that yourself. Restaurants don't make a lot. We have, our margins are so small. And so when you can't just hire a PR company and say, okay, here's $5,000 a month to do this or bust that, you need to do a lot of that stuff yourself. Grassroots is the way, you know what I mean? You need to do it yourself and save that money, because the numbers don't work otherwise, you know?
And when you're building out this one restaurant or this group of restaurants, how much do you focus on competition versus how much you just focus on what you're doing yourself?
Very little. But I think we're a little bit more unique in where we are, is that we don't have a lot of competition in the sense of doing what we're doing or our caliber. We do now. I would say over the years, we've had a lot more great independent restaurants open up and stuff. But I don't worry about too much what other people's doing. I don't even follow chefs on Instagram. I don't really, you know, it's the same thing as I don't really read cookbooks, because I don't really care. It doesn't really change me, or doesn't change what I'm necessarily doing. I do love going out and eating and trying new things and going, oh, I never really kind of thought that. But from where we are, I don't really think about it. But at the same time, we don't oversaturate ourselves. And that's why I've made sure that we don't redo the same thing in the same city. You know, we have kind of a French European, a Japanese, Korean, and Italian. And then the other city, we have a Japanese and Korean and French again. So we don't want to keep doing the same thing. I would get very, very bored of that too. But, and we want people to come back 3 times a week. We don't want them to come back once a month or just on a birthday.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Blinkist. Now, have you ever felt like you just don't have time to read all the books you want? Blinkist solves that problem. With the Blinkist app, you can understand the most important things you need to know from over 5,500 nonfiction books and podcasts in just 15 minutes. It's perfect for discovering new perspectives, broadening your horizons, sparking exciting conversations, upskilling yourself. I personally love Blinkist because it offers a huge variety of content, 5,500 titles, 27 different categories, powerful insights in just 15 minutes. These bite-sized, top-notch audio experiences make it super easy to fit edutainment into an everyday, super hectic life. So now they also have an incredible new feature called Blinkist Connect. And as a premium Blinkist user, you can share your account with another person of your choice, effectively giving you 2 premium accounts for the price of 1. Imagine sharing your favorite titles with your best friend, your peer, your partner. You both can upskill yourself. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience, Success Story Podcast listeners. You go to Blinkist.com/Clary to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Clary to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Clary. And now, for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account, giving you 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Don't miss this amazing opportunity from Blinkist.
Yeah.
No, that makes, okay. So, all right. I think that was like, we really went into the business of restaurants. I want to speak about some leadership lessons that you were sort of, speaking about earlier. Let's talk about some things that you've experienced managing teams in kitchens. And now you're not managing a team every single day. Obviously you have people mm-hmm. that work for you, but like leadership lessons from a super high pressure environment. You even mentioned that it's hard to motivate people. It's hard to get people to work. So what are some things that, that you do to get the best possible team, get the best possible out of that team? Maybe just speak to me about your leadership style in the kitchen, because I think everybody knows the high pressure environment, but, I've never experienced it. So, so walk through that. Maybe we can sort of pull some lessons out for people listening.
I think my leadership has changed. I mean, it changed over the years and has evolved with anything from obviously being a chef in Vancouver doing, say, fine dining. And my leadership was, I would say, more Gordon Ramsay style, in the sense of like, shut the fuck up and do exactly what I'm asking to do and do it. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And if you don't like it, there's kind of the door. And that's, I think when you're at a very specific height of your, career or at a certain place in a restaurant, you can get away with that. That's kind of borrowed time and it's not real leadership. It's essentially, you're doing whatever, you're just kind of doing what you're doing. But again, going back to my son, you know, and learning and seeing people, I guess, for more. When you start doing more casual food, when I started doing more casual food, you can't really keep that type of an intensity going all the time because it's not that intense. And then you're just an asshole. And that's kind of what I kind of figured out, that I was just kind of turning into an asshole and I wasn't that great of a leader anymore, you know? And so, I took that to heart. And I think what a big thing was that I always had people that stuck with me a very long time. And I think it's because I generally would take an interest in their life. You know, I always encourage people to take time off. Like if you have a family thing, I'm going to make it work for you. If you want to take a holiday, I'm going to make it work for you, because you need to have a life outside of these walls, because it's only sustainable for a certain amount of a period of time. These days, because I'm not the chef in any of my restaurants, my role really is a motivator and someone that goes. So I go around from restaurant to restaurant, checking with everybody from, you know, and obviously knowing every single person's name, which is not that difficult. I have only 5 restaurants, but you would be surprised, you know, knowing the dishwasher's name, knowing, you know, everything, checking with the dishwasher, you know, making sure that they have what they need. You know, I've done everything from, like, when we've had a dishwasher that's down and out, doing like a furniture drive where I go around and pick up a bunch of furniture and make sure that they have things for home and clothes for the kids and all those kind of little things that I think is maybe not necessarily a boss kind of thing, but it's building a culture within our restaurants to know that if shit goes wrong in your life, you have people that are there for you. And I think that is actually very important in the hospitality industry, maybe not so much in other industries, because we have a lot of transient people in our industry, and a lot of people that don't necessarily have education. They don't necessarily have things to fall back on. And it's easier to try to fix a problem that they're having at home or in their life than them just leaving and trying to hire somebody else. I found over the years, it's easier to try to kind of nurture those relationships and try to make sure that you can set things up for them to succeed is a lot easier than saying, screw it, I'll find somebody else. Because you get those long lasting kind of relationships. I hired a guy one time, worst interview I've ever had in my entire life. Like I partly hired him because it was so bad. He wouldn't look me in the eye. He was kind of like, all over the place. And I came downstairs and was like, holy shit, I was there. And I said, I hired him. And they're like, everyone was like shocked. I was like, what? And he ended up being with us for 8 years. He just finished with us like 6 months ago. And he was a great employee. He came every single day. He wasn't naturally talented. He wasn't everything, but he would work his ass off. He'd do his 8 hours a day and he would go home. And so I have over the years started to value that almost a lot more than that really talented person that was, you know,
ego.
Yeah. You invest, you know, in people and generally, but that being said, you also set yourself up for a lot of disappointment and especially in this industry as well, is that people do, when you invest a ton of time and energy and everything in them, and then they necessarily leave without notice. Notice these days is not even a thing. I don't know what it is like in other things, but people just don't give notice anymore. They just don't show up, or they just say, well, I'm not coming back, and that's kind of thing. So, I've kind of learned that if you can invest in people and stuff and try to create opportunities for them and if they know that you actually are generally there for them in the corner, from a personal side, then it definitely holds a lot of weight in this industry. But from building a team standpoint, I just check in and make sure my goal is with all my chefs. So I have 5 chefs. My goal is to take care of all the stuff that stops them from doing what they love, and which is cooking. I try to make sure that they can spend as much time in the kitchen. They don't have to deal with too much payroll or too much paperwork or too much everything else. I want them focusing on the cooks and focusing on the food and doing what they love. And when they want to be an entrepreneur and grow from there, I'll teach them or I'll help them move up. Yeah, I just want them to keep doing their job and not have to kind of worry about that. And morale, I honestly, I feel like that's kind of my job now, is kind of keeping people's morale up and then teaching them about the numbers. You know, you kind of have to come and tell them that they're not doing it right, and then tell them how to do it right and how to explain and then prop them up. People, I associate the kitchen and being a father so much, is that especially a young cook or in the middle of pressure, like you said, like if you're in the middle of pressure and you're being a leader and everything, as I find, you know, I tell people I'm a great delegator. I'm probably better at delegating than anything, you know, is that and it's the follow up.
Super, super.
It's so
important.
It's so important, and it's a tool that you can really utilize. It's not laziness. It's controlling. It's a manager of getting everyone the best out of everyone and knowing what their limitations. So I would ask someone to do something, and then I give them a couple minutes or whether a couple days, whatever, depending on the task. Then I follow up. Okay, you know this is coming up. Do you have this kind of done? Okay, and then so I usually give 2 to 3 follow ups, just like you would your kid. And then so when the discipline does come, you've got those. And I also like, and some of my chefs laughing all the time because I'll look them right in the eyes of like, yes, you're agreeing with me. We're having a conversation here. So there's no way you're going to not, when I come to you 2 days later, remember when we talked about that, there's no way you can say we didn't talk about this because we're looking into each other's eyes. Yeah. I'm basically holding your hand going, this is what we're going to do. And so I think when you give people the opportunity to do well and to, you know, it's hard, a lot harder when you say you do this and you show up and you start yelling why it's not done. And you need to follow up and you need to give people structure. And so I find structure is the big thing, and systems and rules and all those kind of things. You need to put those in place for people to grow.
And you're also, you know, you provide a lot of support. You remove the blockers, you remove excuses, you remove any reason as to why they couldn't.
Exactly. Right?
There's zero excuse, but that's your job too. It's like, it wouldn't be fair for you to impose all these things onto them if you didn't give them the best environment to thrive either.
That's much than I did. Yeah.
No. You're good. And I'm curious, like, we've gone through COVID, we're now going through recession, inflation. How does that impact the people that you work with? How does that impact your restaurants? You even spoke about mentality towards work, towards grinding it out. So that's one thing, but also for a while, the restaurant probably couldn't have people working inside it for a period of time, right? So that impacts your bottom line. I don't know if you furloughed or not, but if you lay people off. But then also now people think we're going into a recession. Mm-hmm. I mean, in expensive cities, it's probably very hard with minimum wage. So this all impacts you. It's all impacts the people that you're working with. So walk me through how you've managed some of this.
Slowly, you know, when COVID hit, we were on a really good trajectory when COVID hit, and me and my partner had spent kind of 6 months prior. It was almost like we somehow knew that this was kind of coming, but it was more just like I got really pissed off one day because numbers just weren't working, or things just didn't seem that good. So I went on a tear for about 6 months, me and my business partner, renegotiating everything from POS stuff to credit card fees to everything, like linen. We went through every single cost item, and we got it to dialed in as much as possible. And then COVID hit, boom, like right kind of there. And then I feel like if we wouldn't have done that massive house cleaning, we would have been a lot more in a lot worse of a situation. But because we did that and we were really, really quite tight, you know, we had a good opportunity to, and all of our restaurants came out fine. And, you know, we obviously took the subsidies and did all the programs and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, if you didn't, you probably wouldn't be alive anyway, or you wouldn't be in business. I mean, so for us, you know, it was about keeping our staff and keeping people employed and trying to just minimize our hurt to get through it. And that's what I think everyone was doing for the early part. But then once we realized this is a long-term thing, then we had to kind of start kind of changing kind of our ideas and kind of, and stuff, and finding other ways to cut costs and make money. It's the worst case scenario, to be honest with you, like a pandemic and for the hospitality industry, I would say hospitality got hit the hardest. It always gets hit the hardest. As soon as a recession hits, the first thing you do is stop going out for dinner. You know, it's an easy thing to cut. You can make dinner, you can buy cheaper stuff, you can do whatever. When a pandemic hits, you know, most businesses some businesses thrived. I have friends that did way better in the pandemic than they've ever done. But, you know, nickel and diming burgers and doing all these pack ups and doing all these things. And, you know, everyone's like, oh, why don't you do online cooking class? Once you do this and that, and you pack up these things or order boxes where people can make food at home and stuff like that. And you're like, it's just a bunch of busy work that doesn't make money, you know? And so I did all the costing and did all the analysis, and we chose not to do any of that stuff. And the people that I saw doing it were losing their money. I chose from a personal standpoint, I used the pandemic time better than I could have ever imagined. I became healthier, happier. I did a lot of, you know, mental kind of growth. I became a triathlete. I train 15, 16 hours a week now.
That's very good.
You know, I wanted to use my time, use this time. It was almost like a gift of when do you ever get to kind of really reset and really look at everything. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
So I looked at that as a very positive period. Our cities specifically, or our restaurants in our cities, really rely on business tourism. Saskatchewan, like I love Saskatchewan. We all, you know, everything like this, but nobody's coming for a holiday in Saskatoon. You know what I mean? It's very rare. You know, like it's like I always say, people like, oh, I've never been to Saskatchewan. I'm like, yeah, generally, if someone gets married or dies, is usually when you come, if you don't from there.
Yeah.
And so we need people coming in for potash and for oil and for gas and for agriculture. We need those people coming in because from Monday to Thursday, you know, local's good, but it's not gonna get me 150 people in one restaurant and 60 in the other. You know, I can't fill all my restaurants on regular Wednesday business. I need people from Toronto, Calgary, Edmonton coming in that are gonna have a bottle of wine and have three or four courses. And so that is starting to come back. And so we're just adjusting, renegotiating leases. I renegotiated numerous of our leases to percentage rent. You know, the pitch is like, you can either have me as a long-term tenant or I can be out of here in a year because I'm not going to be able to pay your bills.
Yeah.
Or you,
by the way, I want to just tell you, like, none of this is meant to be elegant. It's just meant to be real.
Yeah.
That's really what I know that this is a very difficult, but you're in hospitality and it's interesting how people navigate it.
Yeah.
Even though it's not fun and
no, it's terrible. It's terrible. And when you're standing there and you're nickeling and diming and you're, And the worst bit about all this, all of our costs are going skyrocketing during all this time too. Like all of our food costs, our liquor costs, our labor costs, our minimum wages going up. People are choosing to be on public government programs rather than come to work even as well, especially when we're first coming back. And then again, to go back to our restaurants, we're full service restaurants. Like we're concept restaurants. When you come to us, you're coming because you get greeted a certain way, because we have nice bathrooms, because we have great food. So when you can only, well, you know, we're at a point where at sometimes we can only seat 25 to 50% of the restaurant. Do you really want to come and pay $48 for a beautiful steak and sit in an empty, have mostly empty room with no ambiance going, everyone wearing masks and cleaning everything? It's not a vibe. It's a vibe, but it's not a vibe you want. And it's not a vibe you want to come in and have. And so we struggle to try to create that ambiance still. So it was very challenging, a very, very, very challenging period. And we definitely lost a lot of people in the industry.
No, do you think that going forward hospitality will change? Like are you going to structure your businesses and your restaurants different going forward, or is it going to slowly morph back into what it used to be?
I think we're always going to be more efficient because of it. I think, you know, we've been forced to look at the numbers more often and all the numbers and costs and I think too, the only positive I think that has come out of this is the fact that everyone, with the inflation and everything going up so much and cost of goods going up, this is the first time in, I think, history that I've ever been in the industry that the general public has realized that how much more everything costs. And so we can't, you know, when we raise the menus, you generally are getting a bit more support of raising the menu prices rather than being, you know, a dollar more for chicken wings or whatever it is. I can go make these at home. Well, then you're like, we'll go make them at home. But this is just what it costs now. Like for you to go buy a steak in the grocery store, a decent steak, it's going to cost you $8, $9 to $20 for a steak, whatever cut that is. But it's the same as a restaurant. So I think people are starting to understand a little bit more of the cost. We just have to keep raising the prices. And that's, I've raised my prices more in the last 12 months than I've ever had in my whole career. Like every month, basically having to go up, because the number, at the end of the day, if the numbers don't work, you can say, oh, people are going to stop coming. But if they start, it doesn't really matter. If you keep serving food, you're breaking even or losing on, then you might as well have less guests and make it and still
they
make
might
more
as
money.
Well just not come anyway. So you got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we're happy, you know, we're optimistic of this year. We still did okay last year. And I think, this year is going to be different. Caterings have come back, which is a big part of our, you know, one of our revenue streams is weddings, corporate events, all that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, for 2.5 years, no company was willing or wanting to do anything like that. Marriages, you know, all the weddings got scaled down or doing different stuff. And so we see that business coming back, thankfully, because that's, you know, it's a lot of our bread and butter.
if you had to pick one lesson that you've learned over your entire career and tell it to your younger self, what would that lesson be? It could span food, restaurant, business, anything.
I think the message I always tell myself, I got asked the question, if you were a book, what would the title be? And I said, shut up and listen, you know, is a good message, I think, for any entrepreneur. Sometimes I think, as I mentioned, ambition can kind of get in your way. But a lesson that I feel like I learned early on, and I stick to all the time is numbers don't lie. You know, you have to, as much as you want something, if it's not working, financially, it's not a business. It's a pet project, or it's something that's just going to keep sucking up money. So, I think you have to be realistic and be mature enough to, and also just admit when you're wrong. If you're wrong, you're wrong. You know, I get taught that all the time from my cooks, from my staff, from other mentors and stuff. You know, I think there's great power in admitting when you're wrong and admitting that you need to learn some more stuff still.
No, very good. Okay. So I'm going to close this out and get some places, some links and some socials. But before I pivot, was there anything that you wanted to speak about, teach over, to the audience, anything that's top of mind? Either it could be lessons for young entrepreneurs, it could be where you want to go in the future, goals that you want to set. So floor is yours. So just take a second, close it out, and then I'll do like a couple last questions.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I didn't really think about a closing thing, but from my standpoint,
you don't have to think it.
From my standpoint is, you know, I think, and this seems such a cliche these days, but I honestly, balance, I always make fun of the whole balance thing, but as I've got older, I really need to have balance, and I really need to have other things outside of work. You know, I need to have, before we did this, I ran 15 kilometers. You know, that makes me more happy than almost anything, because I just feel healthy. I feel happy. It makes me want to get out of bed. It makes me want to go. So I think you have to have other outlets. You have to be, focused on what you're doing, but you also need to have outlets, and you also have to have some happiness in your life. It can't all be. And my side is, I came from, again, such an aggressive, like, it was the more miserable you were, it was almost like the better chef you were. It was almost like badges of honor. And I'm like, I think it's pretty good to smile. It's being mad all the time is exhausting. So I kind of celebrate just being happy and love the people you work with. You know, and as an entrepreneur, you know, you have to keep them accountable, but at the same time, you've got to create a place where they want to be, and they're coming, they're getting out of bed every morning for you and for your business. So appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that's very good. If people want to connect with you, learn more about your restaurants, go visit your restaurants, yeah, if they're up in Canada right now, website, social, where should they go?
My Instagram is at Chef Dale McKay, at Chef Dale McKay, and then grassrootsrestaurantgroup.com.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. And then I ask this question to everyone to close this, mm-hmm, out. So over the course of, you know, you've had an incredible career, you've worked with some of the best chefs in the world, you've built your own empire of restaurants. After all of this, and you've alluded to it before, but what does success mean to you now?
I don't want to always say financially, but financial, I think when you... being able to work less is success for me. You know, being able to have the ability to work 8 hours a day and really use those 8 hours to do better than working 16 and being exhausted all the time. And I think you can only get that with somewhat financial success or at least strength or stability, consistency. Mm-hmm. That would be say.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know.
Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins. And I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive. And I bet you we've all been there. And maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay. And what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.